Cosmic Shed.
Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew and with me today is
Ty.
And it's May the 4th, or at least we're releasing this on May the 4th. So we thought we'd have a man with us who's written books in the Star Wars universe, among many other things. Kevin Scott, welcome to the Cosmic Shed.
It's very nice to be. It's very cosy, isn't it?
I know, it's lovely.
I like it. It's a podcast when you get a cup of tea when you walk through the door.
Yes, we're all drinking tea.
Two of us are drinking tea.
Beer. And
if you haven't got a drive anywhere.
No, that's true.
We're being responsible.
It's your shed.
It is.
The only danger is you're falling into a pond.
Yes. So, one of the
which I'm hoping we'll see later.
Oh yeah, it gets very dark out there outside the shed.
Ty, you go a little bit back with Cav, don't you?
One of my first jobs out of university was as an editorial assistant at BBC Magazines on Who Do You Think You Are and Who Do You Think You Are magazine. And Cav was a head editor and in charge of Country File, so I was very much the junior. And he was quite a senior expertise, someone who would just rule a magazine with an iron fist. I'm joking. He, out of all the editors, Cav was one of the nicest ones, and I knew he was nice because he was a big star, a big fan of Blake 7 at the time, which I love, thanks to my uncle lending me all the VHSs when I was younger. But no one else knew what Blake 7 was, but I think because Cav did, I was like, I like this guy.
Yeah, awesome. Right, so we know you used to work at BBC Magazines.
Yes.
We know you write Star Wars books.
Yes.
Can you fill in the gaps?
Yeah, sure. Well, it actually goes back beyond that, before that. When I used to work at Future Publishing for the BBC, I worked on a magazine called T3, which is all about technology and toys and things like that. And as a sideline, I started to write Doctor Who plays, as you do. It was back in the day when Doctor Who, no one cared about Doctor Who. The BBC really didn't care about it. And Big Finish, who produced CDs, audio dramas with the original cast, started developing their range. So the BBC just sort of gave them a license for like tuppence, I think. You know, it's probably a bit more than that. It's probably the managing director of Big Finish is now shaking his fist at me. But it was, you know, first small fry compared to what Doctor Who is now. And a friend of mine who was working on the mag with, Mark Wright, we were both Doctor Who fans, we both wanted to write. We didn't really have the impetus to do it on our own. So sitting in a pub, we came up with an idea for a Doctor Who story, sent it in when they were starting up, and miraculously, it got commissioned. And so it became my sideline, that magazines were my bread and butter. And that's what I went in when I was grown up-ish in the day. And then at home, I'd be writing tie-in stuff to things like Doctor Who. And again, because Doctor Who was quite small then, that was fine. You can do that. You could get away with a lot of things. And then suddenly 2005 happened and Doctor Who came back in a big way. And so I was just at the right point to be doing that, because then suddenly they needed people to write more Doctor Who. So the people who were doing it at that time got the gigs. So over time, it got to be that my sideline became, you know, took up more and more time. And so I started taking days off of doing magazines until the point where it sort of flipped and I could do this full time.
Yeah, awesome. So Doctor Who, back in the day, were you did Big Finish kind of give you a doctor and you have to write a story, or do you pitch it to them? How's it work?
You pitched just for a story. So the first story we pitched was a Sylvester McCoy story, and it ended up being a Colin Baker story. So it all depended what Gary, the producer at the time, what he had on the schedule, what, you know, what kind of stories he wanted told for whatever doctor. And I think at the time as well, Colin Baker's reputation within Doctor Who wasn't as great as it perhaps is now. And so they were looking at stories that were let him show what he could do. So our first story, Project Twilight, was quite a horror based. It's absolutely horror. It's got horrible body mutilations. You couldn't do it now in Doctor Who, because at the time there were no restrictions.
Yeah.
And we were writing basically for a fandom that was now in their 30s and their 40s. I cringe now thinking what would happen if an 8-year-old picked up that drama. Because there's one horrible scene where you've got a gangster who's breaking someone's finger as they're playing This Little Piggy Went to Market and stuff. And it's like, all done with celery to make the snap. but looking back now, I mean, that was fine then. So yeah, at the time they were looking for stories that Colin could really get his teeth into. So the story that we put, thinking it would be a dark Sylvester McCoy-esque story, they went, no, put it to Colin. It was the best thing that happened for us, because it was just the point that people were listening to Colin on audio and absolutely loving what he could do.
Yeah.
And so that was, yeah, that was the beginning.
Awesome. And more recently you've written or contributed to the Missy Chronicles?
Yes. Yes, so that was last year, for the last series of Peter Capaldi's Doctor, I wrote one of the tie-in novels, The Shiner Man. And so, because I was working on that, I was talking to them about Missy anyway, because she had a role in the last series, and I kept saying, wouldn't it be great to do a Missy novel? As in, wouldn't it be great if I did a Missy novel? And they kept going, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And Albert, the BBC, was going, yeah, we're really good. And I kept throwing all these ideas at him. Lo and behold, they were planning the anthology. So luckily, because I badgered him that much, he remembered that and offered me a chance to write one of the stories. But yeah, that was great fun. Because she's such a marvellous character anyway. So you can do basically, my pitch was I'd do a third Doctor story, but with Missy in the third Doctor's role, because the Time Lords always sending the third Doctor out to do stuff. What if they had to send Missy instead, what would happen? So those really nice moments when you know you're writing for a really solid fan base as well, so everyone's going to get all the references and you can put stuff in. And so yeah, that was a lot of fun to do.
When you're writing a character like Missy or Doctor Who, it's a character that already exists and people already love. And how does that feel?
Terrifying most of the time. With some of the stuff I've been doing recently for Star Wars, the Choose Your Own Adventure book, the Choose Your Destiny book that we've just brought out, when they said, would you like to write Han Solo, I obviously went yes, and then I had sat down and had a little cry because I've got to write Han Solo. That's really hard because... Personally, for me, massive character, just like Doctor Who, you know, big part of growing up. Also, there are millions of people around the planet who love that character and who would be really upset if you get it wrong. So, yeah, there's a massive amount of fear, which I think then makes you do the best work you can, because you don't want sort of people turn up at your door with flaming torches and pitchforks. But there's a sense of responsibility, because someone's given you this character for however long you're writing it. And so you want to get it right because of everything that's gone before. You know, these characters all have great legacies. And I've been lucky that I have written for characters that I grew up loving. My to-do list now is pretty much what my to-do list was when I was 10, which I always want to maintain. But, you know, they're characters that have been with me for a long time. Yeah. I do write things for other franchises that are perhaps new to me, but you approach that in the same way. There's always going to be someone who loves that more than anything else in the world. So you have to make sure that you treat it seriously.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Well, I've been reading Choose Your Destiny, A Han and Chewie Adventure, in bed, right?
Okay, so that's an image.
I know, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I've been having, basically, choosing my own adventure with Han and Chewie in bed, which is what I've always wanted to do.
Are you frozen in carbonite? Is that how it ended?
Absolutely. What I would say is that you have successfully written Han Solo
and Chewie. Thank you.
It is a wonderful thing. It's just a huge amount of fun. And was it fun to write in the end?
It was absolutely fun. I mean, I've never written a Choose Your Own Adventure type style book before, so that was a shock. Because originally it wasn't supposed to be. Originally when we were planning them, I'd written this other series, Adventures in Wild Space, which was the first thing I'd done for Star Wars, which was a kids series, which originated in the UK. It's one of the only things from Star Wars that's come from the UK. It's part of the official canon, which I say doing inverted commas. From that, they said, would you like to do some more kind of kids' chapter books, aimed at that sort of age group, sort of like 10 to 12, but with the iconic characters? Well, yeah, of course I would. And in the process of talking about that, I found out it's going to be Han and Chewie to tie in Solo. Very excited about that. And then it was just sort of slipped into a conversation. Oh, by the way, we want it to be like a Choose Your Own Adventure style book. And I went, oh, that's absolutely fine. I can do that. And turned off Skype and went, how the hell do I do that? And so, yeah, I had to sit down and sort of like reverse engineer a Choose Your Own Adventure book to work out how to do it, which it adds its own particular challenges. But it does mean you can do lots of things you can't do usually in canon Star Wars stories. I can blow up the Millennium Falcon if I want to, you know, because it will get put back again if you go back and remake the choices. So, yeah, you can sort of put the characters into situations you could never usually do, which is obviously amazing fun.
Yeah, no, it's awesome.
you've obviously written across a wide range of IPs, which we're going to talk about.
Mm.
Growing up, what were the franchises that you latched onto? Was it always Doctor Who and Star Wars and Blake 7? Were those the big three in your life that influenced you, or were there any others that you kind of gravitated towards and that maybe in the future you'd like to write for?
Star Wars and Doctor Who, I was a child of the 70s. I mean, you can't be a child of the 70s and not love Doctor Who and Star Wars if you're in the UK. Yeah, Blake 7 was there as well. I probably... By the time you get to the 80s, and I was massively into cartoons, and so for me, Transformers was massive. I think Transformers and probably He-Man were the first ones, toy cartoons, where actually had proper plot, proper characters, mainly because they were created by Marvel and DC. Transformers especially, Marvel got given a load of toys to make something. And so that's how Optimus Prime and everyone... happened. So yeah, the Transformers cartoon was massive for me, and the Transformers comic that went with it as well from Marvel. And it was because of things like Doctor Who and Star Wars, and the Marvel UK reprints. So for Doctor Who, it was originated material, but the Star Wars Weekly was massive for me.
Yeah.
Before I watched the films, I read Star Wars Weekly, which was reprinting the Marvel US comics, because Marvel's very good at what they do, they always have backup strips from other things. So from that, I was introduced into the Avengers and that kind of thing. So I suppose growing up, I was a bit of a Marvel kid, which, I mean, today is very much a franchise. But yeah, back then, it was quite, you know, you suddenly realise there's all these different things, like the cartoons and the live action and that kind of thing. So, yeah, for me, it was Star Wars, Doctor Who, Marvel, and then DC when I found some DC stuff, and then Star Trek. Mid-80s, Next Generation came along. When I was going...
BBC Two, 6 p.m. Wednesday evenings.
Exactly. Just when I'm going into sixth form or whatever, and I can sit down and be a critic and look at the in-depth meaning of every episode of Next Generation and the Pinocchio aspect of Data's life, and forget for a minute that there's ships blowing each other up, you know. So, and I've been lucky that, you know, I've done the Trinity. I've only written one very short story, comic story for Star Trek, but if I never write another Star Trek thing again, it's ticked on the list.
What was the short story you wrote for?
It was for last year, for the anniversary year, for Star Trek. There was a comic IDW put out called Waypoint, which was lots of shorts throughout all the variations of Star Trek. So I was asked if I could write a Deep Space Nine short, which was amazing.
When was it set? Post-season 7? Or
just literally 2 weeks after The Emissary. So, it's a Julia Bashir story, and it's literally, he's still in that mode of going, I'm brilliant.
Frontier Medicine.
It's called Frontier Doctor.
Oh, there we go.
And it's very much the crew just starting to, I won't say like each other, but to know each other. I'd always hope to write some more Star Trek, but if I don't, that's ticked.
Awesome.
What Star Trek would you like to write?
I'd like to have movies, and I really tried the movie era, the sort of the Shatner and Nimoy 1980s, because that was my Star Trek
right. Before
Next Gen came on. I don't think I actually watched that much of the original series, but I went to see Wrath of Khan
and
became obsessed with Wrath of Khan. And again, there was a DC comic series that carried on the story, and then every few years had to backtrack massively when the new film came out, because I don't think they ever had any idea of what was coming in the next film. So.
Well, isn't there that lost kind of time period in the movies in between the motion picture
and
The Wrath of Khan, where there's like another 5-year mission?
Well, there's that as well. But then after Wrath of Khan came out, they put out a DC series. I think it was actually after Star Trek III, after the Enterprise spoilers is destroyed. I know. What have I done? There was an entire DC comic series when they get given the Excelsior and they go off and have massive adventures, and Sulu's a captain and Kirk's back at being a captain again, and then suddenly they lose that ship again and have to go back and we left that Klingon bird of prey on Vulcan, and should we go back to there instead? Because suddenly they were obviously told, but hang on a minute, if you're in Star Trek 4, they're all still on Vulcan, are they? Okay, good. Back to that. And at the time I was thinking, this is mad, but now having written quite a lot of tie-in stuff, I know.
Also, they're
exactly
all still under court martial, and
yeah, exactly.
They stole stuff,
you know. And the Excelsior has a cloaking device, and there's all this mad stuff, you know, which I loved. And so, yeah, so that era. And then when IDW asked me to if I could write something, well, not asked me if I'd like to pitch, didn't ask me if I could write. Would you like to pitch for this? I repeatedly pitched stories set between Wrath of Khan and Undiscovered Country, because I think for me, that's the moment when I think of Star Trek. I think of them in the red uniforms with the sort of like little
tear away.
And is that how it works? You couldn't just write it, you have to be given them.
Oh yeah, you can't just but there are certain people in this industry who can just walk in and go, I want to write this today, and people will fall over themselves.
Isn't that how Ronald D. Moore got started? His girlfriend was working on Next Gen, and he walked in with like an episode idea,
right,
gave it to someone, and they went, all right, you can write it.
Yeah, that doesn't
and
happen very often.
No, it doesn't. But that's how we got started in
it. It doesn't year. Happen for legal reasons, because, you know, I mean, you can't write to Marvel and say, I've got a brilliant Spider-Man story, because they won't open it. Because if they ever have a story that's like it, you can say, that's my story. So you have to be, you know, you have to wait to be invited, and you're constantly knocking on the door and saying, can I pitch, can I pitch? And there's plenty of things I pitch for that never happen, and you know, it's like any part of the business. Once you have started having getting a name for writing for one property, you know, that helps. Like, yeah, all these things, you know, the fact that I'd written Doctor Who for so long led me to write things like Blake Seven revival of Big Finish, and because of that, you talk to someone. Oh, I remember Blake Seven, and they just so happen to be working on another property. You have to be trusted as well, because you're dealing with big franchises. You have to be trusted that you're not going to reveal what's happening in the next film, the next TV series, the next whatever. And you have to be on time, which is the biggest part of writing tie-in stuff. It's, you don't get a lot of time to do it, you know, deadlines are tight. So there's it's a very certain skill set within writing. And I know a lot of people who are proper writers, but you know, write their own material, you know, don't write perhaps licensed material. Then come into a world when they write something for another property, and that can cause problems because, you know, they're perhaps not used to working within certain parameters. And I know I've got friends who've tried it and gone, it's not for me, for various different reasons, from just the time restraints, or you know, you can't have a lot of ego writing this stuff, because at the end of the day you are always playing in someone else's sandpit. And while depending on what you're working on, you can argue your point of why it should be like you've written it, or if you've got an idea, at the end of the day, if the person who owns the character, who owns the universe, says, well, no, you have to go, okay then.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, can be challenging.
Well, I mean, it is coming out on May the 4th, this episode, so let's talk about Star Wars and yes. Solo. You've written a couple of Han Solo adventures and Wild Space. Mm. So when you're writing these, what constrictions are in place? For example, if you're writing something about Han and Chewie, and Han, you might want to mention Chewie's family. Do you go... Are the names in the Star Wars Holiday Special still canon?
Yes, they are.
Are they going to be in Solo? Do we? How much do you know? How much do they tell you to make sure that what you're writing sticks in canon and will fit into the story of the film, and you're not wildly off base?
The answer is they don't tell you a lot from the off. Okay. As you work on things, you start realising. There, at Lucasfilm, there is a group called Story Group, and since Disney took over, the Story Group have been in place to make sure it's a consistent universe, and they are brilliant, and they know everything about, I mean, there is a thing called Holocron, which has everything that's happened so far in sort of the new canon since canon was rebooted, and they maintain that. Leyland, who's the keeper of the Holocron, he keeps that completely. He knows everything. The rest of the Story Group are equally as knowledgeable. And there's certain people who have different responsibilities. There's a guy called Matt Martin, who I work with on the comics. There's Leyland, who I work with on the books. They know everything. And they also know what's coming up in 3, 4, 5 years' time. And there are moments when you're told you can't do that, and you can't really ask why, but you sort of know why, because it's obviously you've stumbled on something. And it happens It's happened to me 5 times so far, really? I think. Okay. So when I started writing The Adventures in Wild Space, I basically wrote the beginning of Rogue One without realising it. and was told I had to remove stuff and change things, and you can't have a child being left on a planet by the parents, and you can't do this. Oh, right, okay. Can I ask why? No, you can't ask why. Oh, okay, fair enough. And I came out of Rogue One, and I phoned one of the editors and went, I now know. He went, yeah, fair enough. When I plotted the Han and Chewie adventures, the Choose Your Destiny book, I managed to stumble on things again. There's something I'm working on right now, which I can't mention what it is or whatever, but again, it was all going through the first levels, and then I got a phone call saying we need to Skype tomorrow because we're following someone else's path at the minute. So, because it obviously, if you work a lot in the universe as well, you hopefully are in tune with it, what's going on, so it's quite easy to find yourself duplicating stuff that you don't know about, because you're obviously thinking about what the logical, you know, conclusions of things are. So it does happen a lot. What I would say about story group is they're very good at saying, you can't do this, but why don't you do that?
Yeah.
And everything I do, I mean, I'm constantly sneaking in little references to Marvel Comics from the 1970s. I mean, one of the things I've just been... Jackson, who's the Green Rabbit from the original Marvel Comics run of Star Wars, who was removed quite early on in the run, hasn't been seen for 40 years until last week when I wrote him a comic. it came out last week. But that was very much... I couldn't just say, I'm going to write Jackson. They had to come in and say, would you like to bring Jackson back? And I elected it for various reasons. But I'm constantly putting stuff in, and I always highlight, if it's something from old canon, now called Legends, from the old expanded universe, I highlight this to say, this is from this, is that all right? And sometimes I'll come back and say, yeah, that's fine, let it through. And other times I'll say, let's not.
Mm-hmm.
Also because you don't want it to be a continuity fest. And I always try, if I have a reference in there, that it's not going to be something that if you don't know what it is, it won't derail you.
Yeah.
But if you do know what it is, you go, yay, Easter egg. I know, I got that. But I never try and slip something in, because that's the worst possible thing.
Yeah.
And they will notice, you know.
Is what they tell you ever in flux? Because after The Force Awakens, J.J. Abrams clearly had an idea where he wanted to go, and Rian Johnson took that, let's say, threw it out the window, wrote what he wanted in the Star Wars film, and has now left J.J. Abrams kind of going, and now you've got to follow on with what I did, because I think J.J. Abrams has said his idea about Rey's backstory was very different from what Ryan's established. So with, you say the story group knows what's happening 5 years down the line, does that ever change? Have you ever faced something where you've written something and they've gone, you can't do that, and then it's kind of come back, actually you can, that thing's no longer happening?
Not so much in Star Wars. I mean, I've worked on other properties where with films and TV shows that are being developed at the time, and there's reshoots and that changes. I mean, that happens quite a lot, especially reshoot. With Star Wars, I mean, it hasn't been... I mean, by the time I started to write Star Wars, Rian was already writing, so it's before Force Awakens came out, but Rian had already really pretty much written the story, because he was writing that alongside Force Awakens being developed. Yeah. So I don't think there was really ever a point where it was that turbulent, because it was almost happening at the same time. From my point of view, that's all, you know, the only thing I could see. I mean, there are things probably now, but again, they're very good at protecting the writers from that, because we haven't got time to be thinking of that kind of thing. So there are probably, I don't know, I would think that there are flags that they wouldn't let you go anywhere near it, because it's something that could change. But yeah, it happens a lot. I've worked on stuff at the time with a TV show, even stuff with Doctor Who, and suddenly something will change because there's been an edit and they've realised, oh, we need to change this, or you can be doing a tie-in stuff that's based on something that doesn't end up in a film, you know, because it's cut in the final thing. And so, yeah, things do change, and it can be a last-minute change, but all of these, you've got to learn to react really quickly in doing all this stuff, because things might change tomorrow.
Well, reshoots and changes have gone very much hand-in-hand with the Solo production, to the point where Paul Bettany's character wasn't originally in it. It was a Michael Kenneth Williams from The Wire. I think that's his name. He was going to be a CGI alien, and when Lord and Miller left the project and Ron Howard came in, apparently there were whole lots of reshoots. Did any of that changed the course of your book at all, or is that all kind of...
No, I mean, I've written, including the book, I've written four or five Han Solo things now to tie in Solo, mm-hmm. and none of it was affected or changed. Oh, so
awesome.
There are points where they did say, put in a generic planet here, mm-hmm. and we'll put in an Easter egg, you know, so that, you know, and so stuff will come back saying we should probably change this too, because it's something that's been developed in the film. So there are moments when you leave those gaps.
Okay.
So they're not necessarily going to be something major to the plot, but you know, you've put, you know, it's almost to, you know, fill, put text in here, because then that's a way of getting those moments in. So the idea as well, if you read this book, and also Last Shot, which is the novel that came out on the same day, there are clues to what happens in the film, you know, and they were put in quite later on in the process. So the last draft, I had some notes in, put this in. No real explanation of why, but it's all stuff to tie in and drop in to, and they're also very good at going, oh, you've put that in, well, we could just turn that slightly and it becomes a reference, you know. So I would dread to think what it's like in the office. They must have so many spreadsheets and databases, and but they live it, you know. Yeah. And I was over at Lucasfilm in San Francisco recently.
Which is what we wanted to ask you. Did you go to Skywalker Ranch?
No. I went to the headquarters, which is behind the Yoda statue.
Kathleen Kennedy?
No, I walked past her office.
Was she in?
I don't know. We weren't allowed to look.
Don't look directly at her.
No. So you're in a different kind of pay grade if you go to Skywalker Ranch. That's the next level up, you know. So Jason Fry, who did the Last Jedi novelization, he went to Skywalker Ranch, and Jason's been writing Star Wars for years, and that's his first time. So hopefully one day I'll get to walk through the hallowed doors. But I was like a kid in a candy shop, because it is just filled with the most amazing stuff. Because not just Star Wars, it's where ILM are. So the Ghostbusters room, I was freaking out. Because you talk about other franchises, I mean, Ghostbusters, I was a huge Ghostbusters fan, still my favourite film probably to this day. And there's a Ghostbusters 2 room, which is just full of stuff from Ghostbusters.
Just like a picture of Vigo on
the wall. There is the picture of Vigo on the wall. There's the brothers, the ghosts from the judge scene. There's a couple of Slimers, because it's all real. It's all practical effects, you know. So that's fantastic. There's the spaceship from Inner Space there.
Awesome.
There's all this stuff that is just around. Loads of stuff from the first and second Pirates with Bill Nye's character.
Davy Jones,
the sort of original casts and stuff and things. And yeah, so you do end up being if you're a bit of a film geek, which I am, I just walked around trying to be professional and was basically told very early on, don't worry, we've all done this.
Yeah.
There's just so much there. And artwork on the walls for Lando Calrissian books I remember getting, you know, back in the day and stuff, and so, and it's all just there.
Mm.
A matte painting from E.T. with all the pinpricks for the stars that they would have shone through the back. There's just so much stuff there. It's amazing. The first time I walked onto the TARDIS set I've been on, luckily enough to be on three of the modern day TARDISes.
Nice.
And especially the last one, the Capaldi and latter years of Matt Smith, because it is a complete room. It was a complete room, it doesn't exist anymore. But you walk through the door, and once you were in through the police box door, you were properly in the TARDIS, because there is no room for the cameras, because they removed the walls to put the cameras in. So it's a 360-degree set. And there was a moment when I was on set when they were recording Thin Ice, the episode of the last series when they're in Victorian, on the Victorian Frost Fair.
And there's the thing under the ice. Yeah,
under the ice. And I was doing Rachel Stott and I, an artist on the Doctor Who comics, we were doing workshops at the Doctor Who Experience, and they said, would you like to come over and see a bit of filming? But yeah, obviously. Peter will be there, but he's going to be very busy. Don't expect to see, you know, speak to him. You'll see him, but don't expect to speak. So we're on there. I was chatting to the director, and suddenly there's a Scottish voice behind us, and you turn round, and Peter Capaldi is standing there in Victorian outfit, chatting away, and it's just everyone says it, but is the most lovely man in the world and was the best ambassador for the show at the time. Knew who we were, knew what we did. When he'd sent Rachel fan art because he loves her art so much, he drew himself and sent it to her. Massively just a part of the Doctor Who world. And then at one point you just said, do you want to go on the TARDIS? And you go, yes, Doctor. And you go, no, I don't mean that, but yes, please, yeah. And for just about, they let him off the set for about 20 minutes. He took on the set and he was just showing us around the TARDIS. And it was just that moment I'm going, I'm with the Doctor. You know, and I've worked with doctors, I've met doctors, but there was just something about that moment of him being in costume, the set going, with, you know, the time rotor going up and down and stuff. And you go, what am I going to see when I walk out that door? And just for that slight moment, you know it's make-believe, but the make-believe becomes very, very real.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, it was incredible.
Are you writing for the new Doctor Who?
Not at the minute. Hopefully one day. I think I've written... I've got the thing though, because I've written for all the Doctors in some way or another, so if I start having one I haven't written for, I'd be really upset.
Yeah.
But with all these things, I never expected to be asked back. I've been incredibly lucky. Everything I do for Doctor Who, I always think if that's the last Doctor Who thing I did, that's fine, because I've done so much now. And even when we were starting out, I mean, we thought that was it. We were going to do the one thing. But yeah, I'd love to. Yeah. And again, I'm seeing a lot of this stuff I do now, especially because I write so much for the sort of younger reader as well. It's perfect for me because I've got two young kids. I've got a 12-year-old and a 10-year-old. Who are just the right age and are so excited about the new Doctor. My eldest daughter just turned around to me the other day, it was announced, going, so I can be the Doctor now, Dad.
Yeah.
Like, yes, you can, but never be an actress. and so I'm seeing all of this stuff. I mean, with Star Wars, they're my own little focus group. They're brilliant because they, independently of me working on it, have got into Star Wars because of Rebels. And so they found, after years of me going, here, watch this thing, they were going, no, they saw Rebels and they became fans. And so it's great. And seeing their reaction to the new Doctor has been amazing. So I'd love to write, but I know everyone is queuing up to write the new Doctor, as always happens, you know, so I'm hoping so.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll happen. But I think I know the answer to this, but do you still love Doctor Who as much as you did back in the day?
I do. I go through moments. I go through times when I've worked on it a lot and I go, I need to have a break from Doctor Who. And it's not so much because I need to have a break so I can remember what it's like to be a fan.
Yeah.
And so the last few years I've done a lot of Doctor Who and I did a lot of Doctor Who comics. I was working on the Ninth Doctor comic for a long time. And everything's sort of come to a bit of a halt because of the sort of break for the new series. There's been a little sort of like, the breaks have gone on. We're just having a moment to breathe. And then come autumn, Doctor Who's back again. And I think it needed it. And I think it's, you know, it does feel like it's a new start again. It feels like it's 2005 all over again. And I'm really grateful for it because it means that I don't know anything about what's going on. And I'm loving that.
Yeah.
Working on stuff for the last couple of years in Doctor Who meant I've read all the scripts. And so there is that moment when you go, I'm going to sit down and watch something I pretty much know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Still don't know completely what's going to happen because things can change 2 days before. So it's quite nice at the minute that I'm trying to avoid spoilers. I'm not going through news sites. I'm actually having a little bit of a... I'm just having a sabbatical from Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time autumn comes, I can sit down and become, you know, hopefully with the family and do the entire... see what the new Doctor's like, and so I'm loving that. But yeah, I do go through it. If you work on something all the time for a long period of time, there are moments when it becomes work, and so you have to sort of take a step back and remember.
Yeah.
And it's also why when you take on a project like this, you have to be really sure, because it can absolutely kill your love for it, because you get to see behind the curtain, and also some projects are harder than others. And so, you know, I think all of us in this who work on this kind of thing have worked on something that will always taint that IP for you a bit because something's happened or it wasn't the easiest thing to do. But usually, if you're a fan of something, it will come back. But it's, you know, after working on something for a while, I do try and have a little bit of a break.
So we've talked about you writing characters that already exist. The characters in Adventures in Wild Space are new, aren't they?
Yes.
So did you create those characters?
We, it was a sort of like... a group of people created them. So what happened with Adventures in Wild Space? In the UK, we have this thing called World Book Day. So every school kid gets a voucher, and there's 10 books published in England and Scotland. I think there's another one published in Ireland as well. They get 11. Every kid can take their voucher, and they can pick up this book for free, or you can buy the entire set for £1 each or something. We call it World Book Day. Like the World Series, it has nothing to do with the world. It's pretty much just the UK. There's usually one of those which ties into a film or to, you know, something. And there was an opportunity for Egmont, who published it, to do a Star Wars book. But there was nothing really that they were already doing to fit that spot. And also, it was before The Force Awakens. So they couldn't really do anything because no one knew those characters. And so Emil Fortune at Egmont came up with the idea, well, can we do something brand new? And it went through all the usual channels, and Lucasfilm came out and said, yeah, sure. So Emil put together a very, very basic structure of the series is about two kids. It's set 16 years before Rebels, so the Empire's new and shiny and everyone loves it. The Emperor's a big hero. Yay!
Isn't that the set around the same time as Solo now?
There maybe.
allegedly.
And so it's the period time where, yeah, the Empire is seen as a good thing because it's brought peace and got rid of those nasty old Jedi. Two kids are exploring with their parents, area called Wild Space. The Emperor wants the maps that they make, they're cartographers. He wants the maps because they want to expand into Wild Space. And so there's a little bit of dealing, and the parents get kidnapped, and the kids have to go off and find them. And so that was the sort of structure for the book series. And it was going to be me and another writer, Tom Huddleston, nothing to do with Loki. we were writing alternate books because we had to write them quite quickly. And all we were given were basically the names of the characters and the rundown for the first book.
Mm-hmm. And how does that feel like, writing something in the... Because I heard Philip Pullman talk about he creates the wood and then he makes the path through the woods. So the wood's created and then you make the path, right?
Yeah, so it was... We knew it was quite nice in a way because it was a period of Star Wars that didn't really exist. And there's tie-ins in the series to Rebels, and the fact that if you've seen Rebels, it's the parents of Ezra are still alive in the book series, and they're sort of the early days of Rebellion. So we were just basically given these very, very, you know, a couple of lines each. So there was no, you know, real idea of who these kids were. We knew the... I don't think we even knew one was going to be the old. We were told one's older than the other. One's a girl, one's a boy, one's called Lena, one's called Milo. You don't have to use those names if you don't want to, which we ended up doing. So you go through the press. We came up with ideas and we sent off the ideas, and it sort of became the series as it was. So, but it was nice because, especially in the early books, there isn't a lot of continuity in them. You know, there is the Empire, and there are planets, and we recognise things in them. I didn't have to worry about tying into everything else, which was actually quite nice. It's my introduction into Star Wars. That thing you were talking about, having to get these voices right, didn't have to, because I was making up the voices.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough to write the first one, the World Book Day one, which meant that I was literally writing the first words those characters said. So it was a nice way into Star Wars. And I think... what I hope happened was, because Lucasfilm saw how I worked on that, that's when they gave me opportunities to start doing the other things I've been doing recently with Obi-Wan and Han Solo and things like that. So it was definitely a nice way in. And it is always nice to add something to it. You don't want to just regurgitate, you know. There's something very nice about going onto a fan wiki, and when you're reading a bit of research and just suddenly seeing something you've created alongside all the stuff that you remember from being a kid. That's one of the nice parts of this job.
Yeah. So all your stuff is now on Wikipedia?
Wikipedia, yeah. The day something comes out, there's a Wikipedia. You know you create a character, there's going to be a page for it tomorrow. Wikipedia is a great resource for so many reasons, but it is very odd that when you're reading stuff through and then you suddenly go, I did that. and the same, there's a TARDIS one as well, the TARDIS wiki. And it's a bizarre But very cool thing.
Yeah.
When you suddenly realise you're part of the bigger tapestry.
I was reading your Wikipedia page earlier, and you very modestly didn't tell us that your book was the top book in that World Book Day.
Yes, I knocked Mary Berry off the top spot that week. I'm very excited about that. And bizarrely, let's face it, it wasn't because my name was on the front, it was because it was Star Wars. But it was the number one bestseller that week in the UK of all books.
Yeah.
It's 100 because it's a weird thing because actually they're all paid for because the vouchers are paid well for someone. So yeah, it sold something like 100,000 copies.
Whoa.
Within a week or something. You know, it's ridiculous. And then I was knocked off the next week by Roald Dahl. And you go, well, fair enough.
Yeah, it's Roald Dahl.
You know, yeah, all right.
Game.
Yeah, exactly. He hasn't written one for a while.
lazy.
it was bizarre. Absolutely bizarre. But yeah, it shows the power of these kind of books for kids.
Another franchise you recently worked on was Pacific Rim.
Yes.
How did you get involved in the world of kaiju and Yeagers?
I was introduced to Robert Napton, who's at Legendary Comics. He's the head of Legendary Comics. Massive Doctor Who fan. And Paul Cornell, Doctor Who writer, introduced us at San Diego Comic Con. And basically, I was blatant. I'm a British writer. I'm not very good at that thing of going, hello, I should write for you, or you should hire me. But when you're at San Diego Comic Con, you've got to be like that, because everyone else is. There are. You go there and you go, I have made a time at San Diego Comic Con. Then you realise, so is the rest of the world. and there are queues and queues and queues of professionals who all do this stuff. I basically came out with it and talked to him about that doctor and went, I really like Pacific Rim. Are you going to do any comics? And he went, maybe. And then I let it go. And I kept like a dog with a bone.
Do you pitch your idea there in the room? Or do you go, so what's the sequel about? And I have an idea that we can work around it.
No, because, I mean, the thing was, A, I don't want to... I knew they wouldn't listen to any of my ideas straight away for the legal reasons I mentioned. Secondly, I knew they weren't going to... They'd only just met me. They weren't going to tell me, oh, yeah, this is what, you know, this is what Uprising... I don't think Uprising even had a name by that point.
It was
so,
Maelstrom.
Yeah, so... I just basically threw my, you know, Jaeger helmet into the ring and went, I love this stuff. And just kept saying it repeatedly. And then it came about that because they looked at what else I've done, you know, and I was persistent as well. They sent me a little brief saying, this is the kind of story we're thinking of. What do you think?
Awesome.
After I'd signed many NDAs. And that one was one that was very much linked to what was happening in the film as well. They, you know, they sent me the script of the film at the same time.
Oh, wow.
And it turned into three projects. So there was Aftermath, which is sort of set between the two films. It's set a year before Uprising. We knew, I think, early on that Hannibal Chow's character wasn't, you know, and Ron Palmer's character wasn't in the sequel.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a case of, what, can we do something with him? You know, can we do something with Chow? And from this as well, it sort of spun into a backup strip, which is Jake Pentecost's backup strip in the comic. And then a line webtoon series I wrote to tie in with the character of Amara, who in Tess was doing very well. So it's one of those moments they say, well, we can do something with this character.
Mm.
And that was a strange one because I was working with... a team in China. I was working with a writer and an artist in China, so it's sort of that really was an international affair.
This is essentially the golden age of geekdom.
Yes.
With Avengers being like the biggest film of all time at the moment. Star Wars, Doctor Who, Star Trek. But it's also the time, thanks to social media, of absolutely toxic fandom. Mm. Especially when it comes to stuff like the reaction to The Last Jedi.
Yep.
Star Trek Discovery got a whole load of backlash from people that clearly aren't Star Trek fans. As someone who writes for a lot of beloved franchises, is this something you faced? And if so, how have you dealt with it? Or luckily, is it something that's just so far passed you by?
No, I have faced it. You get it a lot. A lot of these franchises have that situation where for a long time they are maintained by a small group of fans who buy everything, you know, and suddenly new media comes into it and there are new films, there is a reboot, and the you know, some of those fans go, well, hang on a minute, that's not my version of this franchise. And that's where you get things like the Last Jedi for Rory, which a lot of people go, well, that's not my, you know, hashtag, not my Luke, not my Han. Because they've spent years trying to imagine what that moment's going to be like. And it's exactly the same with Doctor Who. You know, there is still a vast amount of fandom that will not watch Doctor Who post-2005 because that's not Doctor Who, you know. I get very upset when I see how much bile is thrown around with people who love something, who apparently love something, you know. And it does happen, and you do get... I've seen it in conventions, I've seen it on social media, but I always try and hold on to the fact there is also a group of people who love this. Working on it from the inside, you also know that no one plans to make anything that's going to do this. You know, no one plans to make a film that is going to completely rip fandom apart. No one plans to make a film that has destroyed your childhood. They're just making a film, or they're making a book, or they're making a comic. You get a book out, you get a comic out, some person out there will rip it to shreds online, post their review, which is their right, and they can do that. Then they will tag you into it, so you have to see it. Horrible. I always bear in mind that, you know, if I rip into something online, someone might see that one day who's actually involved in it. So it does make me pause and think. So it has removed part of fandom for me. But actually, it doesn't mean I don't do it. I just don't do it publicly.
Yeah.
And I think that's the big thing at the minute. We've turned, because social media, we've turned, you know, that part of fandom when you sit in a pub and you say, did you see that episode of X and X last night? I can't believe they did that. That would never have happened 10 years ago with the old producer. Yeah. And it's gone onto the world stage. And, you know, and there are political aspects to it now as well. You know, it's there's the entire, you know, anti-social justice warrior movement and things. It's all very political. It's all very nasty. And it's not really about genre for me, because genre's all about acceptance. If you look at it, it's all about the outsider and coming together. Usually, most of the series are all about that. The ratio between that group of people and the group of people who absolutely love something and just want to celebrate it is massive. You know, that's the bigger party.
One last question, and it's a simple one. Who were you most excited to write about that you have written about?
Oh, my heavens. I think the first time I ever wrote The Doctor was incredibly exciting, because it's the first chance I had to do it. I was writing for a doctor as well. I wasn't just writing words, I was writing words the doctor was going to say. And there was this moment where I'm sitting in the recording studio listening to Colin Baker do the lines, and there's a moment when he says, let's go back to the TARDIS. And I knew exactly when I wrote that line how he was going to say TARDIS, and the emphasis he would put on it, and the warmth that would be in that word. And it was there. And I just looked at the sound engineer, and we both just grinned at each other. And it was just that moment of going, someone's letting me do this. I'm absolutely loving writing, being part of the Star Wars universe. But I think it all comes back to that moment, because without that moment, I wouldn't be doing any of this. I think it's that moment where Colin Baker said the word TARDIS. Yeah. I think that's when it all started.
Awesome. Gavin Scott, thank you for joining us here in the Cosmic Shed. Ty, thank you as always for being here.
I don't know why I waved, it's an audio medium.
Yeah, but you're wearing a leather jacket, so it's all squeaky.
That's true, yeah.
We did hear you. Yeah. And I don't know what we're going to do next. We've had a flurry of episodes, so sorry for clogging up your phones, everyone. And thank you very much for listening.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.